The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Ross, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the virtual Court of Appeals. We appreciate your willingness to proceed according to the new process that we've been using and will be using for some time at least. So far, I will just say this, if the two of you as attorneys have not yet had opportunity to so argue with it, we've had relative great success considering we're not all together in the same location. And so do let us know by hand gestures or otherwise if for some reason you can't hear any of us. That's more important than seeing any of us, but if you have some technical issues on any of those points, let us know. Despite the new process, of course, that we're using, everything else in terms of our procedure remains the same in terms of 15 minutes apiece with 5 minutes of rebuttal. If you choose, we do ask, because we're recording these proceedings, that you do identify yourself when you first begin your argument. And then we will have the marshal who will be using his phone. You'll see that in terms of the timing. So hopefully that will continue to be visible as well. So if you have any questions, you can certainly let me know. And as I say, use gestures if we can't hear what you're saying, and we'll let you know as well if for some reason. And then typically what we do when there's been some technological glitch, we stop the timer and we see if we can get it fixed relatively quickly. And so we do have three oral matters on our calendar, and you happen to be the first one, our file number A19-1777. And as soon as counsel for appellant is ready, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Mark Thompson. I represent the appellate, Adam Will. This is a minority shareholder oppression rights case that really, it's an interlocutory appeal that really involves a contempt hearing proceeding that went on over 4 days, not this last May, but the May before in 2019. At the conclusion of that proceeding, my client, Adam Will, was found in contempt. And the first question we must address is whether that contempt was punitive or remedial in nature. Because it lacked any purge conditions, he did not have the keys to the jailhouse, as the phrase, I guess the repeated phrases throughout the cases.
Mr. Thompson, could I just stop you at that point and ask you, is it true, however, that there were no jailhouse for which he needed keys to be released from? In other words, there was no penalty in the contempt proceeding for which he would need purge conditions to be relieved of.
Does Your Honor mean confinement?
Yes, confinement or fine, anything other than what we know the court did impose attorney's fees.
Yeah, the imposition that what the court imposed on him that was payable to the other side, Adam Will shall pay to defendant's attorney's fees of $2,500 related to the finding of contempt. The amount shall be reduced from any final distribution he receives as a result of his ownership interest. We believe that is the fine, even though it's couched in attorney's fees.
Can I just inquire, did not the request also, though, include attorney's fees, specifically referencing the 588.11, and would that not be a remedy available over and above or separate, independent of any penalty for contempt itself?
The indemnification statute, I believe you're referring to?
Yes.
That's not clear from the order, I guess. It's not clear if that was the basis that was awarded on or not. And that's why the way we viewed it was it is a fine. I guess I did not see it as, because the court doesn't address it as specifically as being awarded that in that manner, I guess we don't know.
Would you agree if we, in looking at the record, so interpret it as attorney's fees under that statute that it would no longer be a fine. Therefore, there would not it would not need to be a purge condition because there was no separate penalty such as confinement, and therefore it would be a remedial contempt proceeding.
I think we have to still look at what the purpose of the penalty was, and that appears to be to vindicate the court's authority for violations of what the court found to be violations of prior orders. And it wasn't, if it's remedial, it needs to I like to call, I guess, a carrot and a stick sort of effect, where it needs to have some way to coax future compliance or future behavior. And there is none of that here. The only find, he was found in contempt, and the basis for that must have been to vindicate the court's authority, from my reading of the order.
Mr. Thompson, so did the court impose any fine or penalty of some kind for the contempt, for contempt itself, other than the attorney fees?
That's what we believe is the fine.
Well, that's not my question. My question is, putting aside the attorney fees, did the district court say, because of the finding of contempt, I require that you pay into the court a fine of
$1,000, $2,000, $5,000. No, Your Honor.
So they're just to be clear, the only thing that's tied to the contempt are the attorney fee issue. There's not any other type of cost, or you're going to go to jail, or you have to post a bond, or anything like that.
That would be correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and the respondents did not request that he serve a jail sentence, and all they asked for was dismissal with prejudice and an award of attorney fees. So they weren't seeking any type of criminal penalty here, were they?
No, but the order to show cause specifically referenced that that would be, confinement would be something considered by the court at the hearing. And that's what we were prepared for going into the hearing, was the possibility of Mr. Will losing his liberty.
Right, but that would be a separate issue, because if the district court did say, okay, you're going to go to jail unless you comply with XYZ, then that is indeed the situation you're talking about, where he would have to have some type of purge condition in order to allow him to get out of jail, essentially, correct?
I believe if the court would have said, like Your Honor just said, if you don't do XYZ, you're going to jail, that would be remedial. Because that shows that it's trying to alter his behavior and conduct for the future, and it's not strictly a vindicating of the court's rights. That would be something to coax his future behavior.
But a district court has the ability to impose attorney fees, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, that's a separate power that a district court has.
Under the statute, yes, it does. And our position is that this was criminal in nature, and because of that, Mr. Will should have been afforded the proof beyond reasonable doubt standard and the other procedural safeguards.
Mr. Thompson, can I inquire about that? You mentioned briefly that the court did indeed use the preponderance of the evidence standard, and I'm assuming, of course, as you were just saying, that the reason you believe that it should have been beyond a reasonable doubt is because the attorney's fees only in your characterization is a fine. A fine is criminal, and it was not conditional, or it was unconditional, in other words. Therefore, it was a criminal punitive matter and beyond a reasonable doubt. I think I understand that argument. My question for you is, let's assume our court disagreed and that indeed it was a civil constructive remedial contempt proceeding. Do you believe in a civil constructive contempt proceeding, preponderance of the evidence is indeed the correct standard of proof?
I struggle with that, honestly, Your Honor. Researching it, trying to find it, it appears to me that the HOP factors have always been applied, but I've failed to find anything directly. I thought all along that it was a higher standard of proof, not preponderance, but a clear and convincing standard that is applied for contempt proceedings, like it is in virtually every other state and in federal courts. But I did not find any case law directly saying on point that it is preponderance. standard, but likewise, I did not find any that said it's clear and convincing, like I was desperately looking for. Because I think from reading the order, it appears to me that the court had to struggle, had to reach to find, to meet the preponderance of the evidence standard. And with any higher standard imposed, I don't think Mr. Will would have been found in contempt. I hope that answers your question.
It does. And my perhaps follow-up question then is what is your understanding? And I realize I don't believe either you or Respondent's Counsel briefed the issue of the general standard, other than we know what the standard that was applied was a preponderance. What is your understanding of how the court is to consider the standard of proof if there is silence in the law and silence in our statute, at least the 588 statute, in terms of standard of proof?
I do not know the answer to that. I wish I would have looked into that further, but I don't. I just do not know.
Thank you.
I guess my assumption was always that it would be clear and convincing because of the issues at stake. It seems that in a contempt proceeding, there should be a higher burden to meet. But that's simply the law according to me, which doesn't count for much. So, moving on, I guess. I want to make sure I had 5 minutes reserved for rebuttal. Is that correct? I hope so.
That is correct. Yep. You will have 5 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. A lot of this, I guess, is laid out in the brief, but the court found Mr. Will in violation of the oral order from September 27th. That was regarding not to go to the Savage office. This order was never mentioned in the order to show cause. It was not addressed by any of the parties. The first time it appeared was in the order finding Mr. Will in contempt. So we were not prepared to address that at all. The reason that's significant, I think, is because of the timing of all of this finding that he was, first of all, it's significant because I believe it's a due process violation, and that's a de novo review on that. And it's not it goes to the notice part of the due process as well, and that without the proper notice, he can't be found violating that order, period. The significance of that goes to when we look at the evidence that did find Mr. Will in contempt of going to the Savage office property. And it was based on, really, on the testimony of his brother, because the other witness, Mr. McIver, was unsure about the date. First, he said it was the 27th, then he said maybe a week later. There never was this email that alerted Mr. Eric Will, Adam's brother, to this video going off. There was some email that alerted him. This was never introduced into evidence. It would have shown a day to time that this occurred. There's no date stamp on the video. And it just seems to me that this failed to meet, and I know the standard is high here, clearly erroneous on a finding of fact, but it just seems to me that this finding was not supported by evidence when you review the record that the basis that was the basis for that finding. The Mr. Will is not in the video, it's someone else. And we don't know what date it was, and it's his truck, I give you that, but it wasn't Mr. Will. And to find him in contempt for violating that order seems like it was not very well supported by the evidence. Just to quickly, since I only got a few minutes here, notice is also the theme that the main issue with the sanctions order against myself, against counsel. There was no notice provided of any before the order issued. Even in the contempt order, it said that there may be an attorney's fees award going against and or me or Mr. Will. It wasn't until the final attorney's fees order came out that I was aware that sanctions were being imposed. There was no motion brought. If the court was basing this on its under Rule 11, it on its own motion or on its own accord, the attorney's fees are not an available remedy under the literal, the straight language of Rule 11.
Can I just clarify, Mr. Thompson? So the motion itself did not have a request for sanction against you. It was referenced in the order to show cause. At what point during the hearing were you given an opportunity to present evidence in relation to that request?
None. I didn't. It was mentioned during the opening statement, but I mean, that's an opening statement. He just said, we're going to ask the court at the end of this to have Mr. Thompson's law firm be jointly and severally liable for any contempt fine against Mr. Will. So I did not put on any defense whatsoever. I would have gotten counsel for that. I did not. If the court did base it on its inherent authority under that Roadway Express case, I was entitled to some sort of particularized specific notice. And I mean, just so I could have at least known what I was doing and modified my own behavior. If the court was believed I was acting in bad faith, I did not think I was at all. And without any notice of being informed of that, I would have been at a complete loss as to what I could have done to avoid it. It's only after the fact that I got hammered with the order and saw what it said and what the court thought and found. If I would have known that wasn't an issue beforehand, and I think this is the purpose of the safe harbor in Rule 11 and of providing notice of sanctions before they're imposed, is to allow counsel to modify their behavior. And that seems to me to be a big purpose of the law overall. And I would just submit that the court erred in that regard as well. And I see my time's about up here, 30 seconds. Well, I'll end it right there and save it for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Indeed, you will have a rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, if you want to identify yourself for our record, then you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Ryan Tice, and I'm here on behalf of the respondents. I think it's important to set up from the onset here that our goal today is a review of abuse of discretion. I'll note that counsel, our appellant rather, has tried to kind of muddy the waters factually here, but in actuality, the district court was there for the hearings, conducted 4 days of hearings, and was really in the best position to resolve these factual disputes. And I think it's inappropriate to get into that right now, whereas solely we're here to review whether or not sanctions can be opposed based on the district court's findings.
Well, Mr. Tice, it's a little bit more complicated than just abuse of discretion. That's the overall standard that we're looking at, but we also have different standards. For example, any findings of fact we review for clear error, any issues of law, de novo, and one of the key issues here is what standard applies with respect to sanctions. Is it, and we have, and it depends in part, it seems, that it could depend in part at least on what type of sanctions there are, whether they're criminal or civil. So I think that's really where the key issue lies. So I'd like to ask you, what is the standard of review? Let's assume for the sake of argument that it's a civil sanction. What is the standard of review for a civil sanction, and what is the standard of review for a criminal sanction?
Well, and you're correct. Now, the standard of review for a civil sanction is preponderance of the evidence. Criminal would be that higher standard, but we don't see any way that this could be a criminal sanction. I mean, when we're looking through the order, we think the judge very carefully and throughout 27 pages analyzed this and called this a civil hearing and went through all the factors.
Right, but the civil counsel, I have two questions. The first question is on what case law language or rule or statute do you rely on for the preponderance of evidence standard for a civil proceeding? Well, let's start there, and then I have a follow-up question for you from that.
Unfortunately, I do not have that in front of me. I know that I've seen this before, and in fact, wrote a letter to Judge King regarding this issue and found case law, but I do not have that in front of me right now without closing out this window, so I will not be able to do that for you.
Okay.
But as I've said, when you look through the order, it's clear that the court analyzed this in a civil context when looking through the HOP factors, and that it was remedial in nature. And you can look to the last factor of the HOPs there to do that, to show that what can be done to produce compliance in here.
Well, and to that point, Mr. Tice, If it's civil, then there has to be some type of purge condition. What is the purge condition here? It's unclear to me from the district court's order.
I don't think there is a purge condition here. This is outright just a sanction of attorney's fees as a result of having to have the hearing, both for counsel, for the appellant rather. Counsel's was simply a bad faith sanction, which is addressed by the Piper case. We don't see this as there being an opportunity to purge anything. This was simply a hearing to find whether he was in contempt, so to induce future compliance, and attorney's fees that were resulting from that contempt finding, which is Minnesota case law clearly shows is allowed. I mean, we see that all the time. If the case were wasn't that, then every time that anyone came in for a motion to compel and attorney's fees were ordered, it'd be criminal in context, when you look at appellant's arguments.
Right.
Go ahead, Mr. Judge Ryan.
But that seems to be, sounds like the purpose then really is more to punish them for their conduct, and it is in the context of a contempt finding. So that's why this seems to be a little different, and we have to look at what is the purpose, and if the purpose is essentially punishment, then that seems to veer more into the criminal contempt analysis.
Respectfully, we would disagree with that. We saw this as a clear attempt at the court to remedy the situation and ensure future compliance with the orders, and the attorney's fees was simply a result of that, because it's allowed by Minnesota law that you can recover fees for the time that is spent to induce compliance through these contempt hearings. So we don't see this as punitive in nature. It's just that those are the rules when you are forced to go through these contempt hearings, you are allowed to recover attorney's fees for your time spent. So we don't see this as punitive at all.
Can I take you to a more fundamental question that I have, and it regards the due process issue? Where do we look in the record to see that the appellant had notice of that the September 27 order was going to be an issue in the contempt proceeding, so to allow an opportunity to be heard before sanctions are imposed?
I don't know that particular order was in there, but I think again that's kind of distracting from the point here, because there was five separate orders that were involved in this that served as the basis for this contempt. Because the oral order may not have been addressed in there, in no way negates the fact that there was the October 1st order, the August 22nd and August 24th orders, the January 3rd order, which that one was not found to be in violation. But there are numerous orders based on a pervasive non-compliance with these orders that served as the basis for this. So I think to view this or to look at this through simply this January or this oral September oral order takes away from the fact that there was more than enough foundation and evidence to hold him in contempt for a variety of reasons.
Well, would you agree that one of those reasons cannot be the September violation of the September 27 order if there was no notice?
I suppose I would agree.
What should the remedy be for that violation of due process as to that order?
In this situation, I don't think there should be a remedy, just because I don't think that really served as a basis for the order. When you look at the 27 pages, the very detailed language of why these sanctions were imposed, it had very little, if anything, to do with that order. It was entirely based on, excuse me?
Did the district court mention that order in defining what the basis of the contempt was?
I I don't believe so. I don't recall that specifically. My recollection and review of this showed that it was almost entirely due to the breach of the protective order, for failure to for going to the Savage office or directing people to the Savage office, which I'll say counsel said is arguing that it wasn't a violation of that order because it wasn't clear that Adam Will was there. Well, the exact language of that order is that he also shall not direct people to go there, which it certainly appeared that he did. And with testimony, the court found it convincing that he did do that. That he was also found for disparaging respondents to other parties, which was the August 22nd order, interfering with respondents' business, the October 1st order. When I read through the order, those were the basis that I observed the court note for why this contempt order on the part of plaintiff, why the contempt was found, not violation of an oral order. Now, for counsel's part of this, it was just outright bad faith, and as we've seen from the Piper case. That's absolutely worried. It's black letter law that when an attorney acts in bad faith, the court may award monetary sanctions as a result of that. And the court in this case wrote several pages with very detailed findings as to why there was bad faith on the part of counsel. I don't see that as something that should be punitive in nature, because this really doesn't have anything. He's not a party here. It's not civil or criminal in this. It's simply a sanction based on bad faith conduct, which is one in its own right. And
would you agree, Mr. Tice, that the sanction, though, on Mr. Thompson was not included in the motion, and he was not afforded an opportunity during the hearing to present evidence in relation to the sanction? It was simply in the order that followed the hearing.
Well, it was alleged leading up to this numerous times that he had furthered the misconduct shown by appellant. I mean, there was certainly plenty of foundation prior to this showing that he furthered this by, in fact, there was declarations signed with other parties attesting to the bad faith conduct leading up to this. So he clearly had noticed that this was coming. So I would say it's incorrect to say that he didn't have an opportunity to question himself, because he should have known. It was very upfront that we were alleging bad faith conduct on the part of counsel here.
Mr. Tice, I want to bring you back to the contempt finding itself, or conclusion, and I'm referring to the Mahady case that our court had issued, of course summarizing Hop, and so it's often cited together with Hop. And this quote from the case, second, the court must set purge conditions and determine whether the contemnor has the ability to meet those conditions. My question for you is, that seems quite direct. How do we address that sentence from Mahady, since we know here the court did not impose purge conditions? How as a matter of law, or what case or law that you might be aware of, we might cite to indicate that that's not really what was meant by Mahady in a situation like this where the court doesn't impose a penalty?
Well, I think just by looking at really all of the cases cumulatively that we've seen for similar situations where sanctions are imposed for failure to obey orders, and that clearly happens often. I mean, the fact this Piper case has been cited 10,000 times for similar situations, including as recently as April this year by this very court. I can't point to one specifically, but that is the practice.
Now, you're referring to the attorney sanctions. I was referring specifically to the court making a finding and a conclusion of contempt, but not imposing a condition for which there is a purge, other than the argument that appellant's making that the attorney's fees, by virtue of an absence of any other condition, becomes a penalty. And Mahady seems to direct, in following Hop, that there must be a purge condition, which I assume to be a purge condition, there has to be a penalty imposed for which one may purge of that contempt.
Well, I guess I didn't read it in the same way as you. And again, I would just point to the practice. I wasn't able to find any cases that supported that as being the reading of it. Every case that I had looked at, which is commonplace, was that this is allowable, that you are able to provide sanctions to recover your costs in a situation like this, which actual costs are considered, or your actual loss for attorney's fees, which has been cited. We cited two cases, the Amfarov case and the Hansen case in 2006 and one that showed that this is proper. I guess that's all I have for your honors, unless you have any other questions.
I don't see or hear any questions. So thank you, counsel, and the counsel for appellant. Then you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have nothing further unless the court has some questions.
I see no additional questions. Thank you then to both counsel. We will take the matter under advisement. We appreciate your briefing and your comments today and your willing to appear virtually. It worked without a glitch, it appeared. And so thank you both. Have a great day.